Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
They're called critical supply chains. What Biden is proposing. Reaction from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Nabisco closing bakeries in New Jersey and Atlanta. Fighting for change at the post office. And today on the show, the Government Affairs Director for the Labor Federation and the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, February 25th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and most recently, Pandora. Two guests on the show today. We're going to kick things off in a few minutes with Bill Samuel. Bill is the Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. That would be AFL-CIO.org, one of the many proud sponsors of this show. Number one topic of discussion, the COVID rescue plan. We're talking almost $2 trillion. And if you listen to the show yesterday, we had John Murphy of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, and he was specifically talking about one component of that rescue plan, which is a very, very important component, pension relief, especially zeroed in for the multi-employer plans. And that encompasses millions of workers in America. And those plans are hurting. 7 years ago, Congress had an opportunity to help out. They decided to kick the can down the road, and they pretty much said, well, you know what? You're just going to have to cut benefits. Simple answer. Just cut benefits. Social Security, is there a problem? Just cut benefits. Medicare, just cut benefits. I mean, that's the answer from the conservative faction. All right. Well, Democrats are in control, and we'll talk about pension relief. There's supposed to be a vote, according to John yesterday, a vote in the House tomorrow, then it goes to the Senate. He figures something is going to happen by mid-March. We'll get Bill's perspective on that. And we're also going to talk about jobless benefits. That's a component of that legislation. Stimulus checks. I'm hearing like $1,400 per person, depending on income. And raising the minimum wage, that seems to be a really, really difficult one to get through. And some senators, even on the Democratic side, are wondering whether or not that should be part of the COVID rescue plan. Also talk about the PRO Act, that is the Protect the Right to Organize. And once we get the rescue plan done, it's my understanding it's full speed ahead with the Protect the Right to Organize. The post office, we'll touch on that. And we'll see what else. Oh, yeah, the White House meeting last week with all the union leaders on infrastructure. Trumka, Richard Trumka was there. Lonnie Stevenson of the electrical workers. Kenny Rigmaiden, Painters and Allied Trades. Terry O'Sullivan, Laborers International. Mark McManus, the United Association. Sean McGarvey of the Building Trades. Bob Martinez of the Machinist Union, Eric Dean of the Iron Workers, and Jim Callahan, General President of the Operating Engineers. Nice collection of union leaders there, and we'll see what Bill's take is on that moving forward. Trump talked about the infrastructure. You may recall he met with the building trades like the first week when he was president, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. The important thing is, if you're going to rebuild the infrastructure, you better make sure it's union. And that's what that meeting was all about. Later in the show, we're going to link up with Andrew Tinkham. Andrew is the PR director, coordinator for the Ohio Consumer Council Office. Great organization, occ.ohio.gov. And next week, starting on Sunday, is National Consumer Protection Week. And he's going to cover what that's all about. And essentially, it's a week dedicated to help you better understand your rights. And there's a lot of garbage going on right now. People trying to get more of your money, and they try to do it in so many different ways. Scams that go on, and we've talked about that on the show with Andrew, along with the Better Business Bureau, for years. Shopping for natural gas, electricity, and I'll tell you, this is an important topic, especially with what happened in Texas in the last couple of weeks and how gas prices shot up there. So Andrew's going to run all that stuff down as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, you heard Biden talking about Buy America. Got to really make sure that we prop up the industries and bring back industries from China, from Vietnam, from India. Well, yesterday he signed an executive order to help create a secure supply chain, primarily for critical and essential goods. In recent years, American households, workers, companies, they've all felt the strain of shortages of essential products, from medicine to food to computer chips. In fact, last year was a perfect example. Shortages of personal protective equipment, PPE, for frontline healthcare workers at the beginning of the pandemic. And then we get the masks. Where do they come from? China. The other problem, shortages of automotive semiconductor chips. That has forced a slowdown in car manufacturing plants. Take a look at a vehicle today. It is, half of it is electronic. And you know where those chips are coming from? Not America. Nope. And right now there is a shortage, and they're wondering, okay, why can't we produce these here? So essentially, this is what the order is all about. Biden is directing an immediate 100-day review across all federal agencies to address our vulnerabilities in the supply chains of key four products. Number one, pharmaceuticals. We talked about this with the American Legion just last Friday. I mean, the drugs, they were all pretty much put together here. The research was done here, and they're manufactured where? China. I think 80 to 90% of them are. Critical minerals, rare earths. Critical minerals are an essential part of defense, high tech, and other products. From rare earths in electric motors and generators to the carbon fighter used for airplanes. The United States, according to the White House, needs to ensure we are not dependent upon foreign sources or single points of failure in times of national emergency. I mentioned the semiconductors. Large capacity batteries. This is a good one. What are you hearing about vehicles now? Going electric, right? Well, there's going to be a demand for new energy technologies like electric vehicle batteries. By identifying supply chain risk, we can meet the president's commitment to accelerate U.S. leadership of clean energy technologies. And the White House points out, while the U.S. is a net exporter of electric vehicles, we're not a leader in the supply chain. We're getting the batteries from other countries, or at least the components of those batteries. The second part of the order calls for a more in-depth one-year review of a broader set of U.S. supply chains. And we're talking about the industrial base for the defense industry. Recommendations on actions that could be taken to improve resiliency. Let's see here. Consultation with external stakeholders. The government cannot secure supply chains on its own. It requires partnership and consultation with the American people. So they try, and what essentially they're trying to do is engage as many people in this discussion and come up with some solutions and then act on them. That's the important part. Act on them. Got a comment here from Scott Paul. We're going to have Scott on the show. He's been on many times. He heads the Alliance for American Manufacturing. He said, the offshoring of America's critical supply chains has made the United States more vulnerable and less equipped to respond to a crisis. We have learned this lesson the hard way, unfortunately. There are still reports of workers on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic facing PPE shortages. Now there's a semiconductor shortage that has led to factory shutdowns. We're encouraged by the potential for greater economic security launched by this executive order on supply chains over the past decade. The alliance has cataloged serious vulnerabilities and deficiencies in our manufacturing base, ranging from rare earths, semiconductors, and specialty metals. To wrap up his statement, Scott said the most important aspect of the executive order is the policy that ultimately will flow from it. And we'll definitely keep our eye on that one. Earlier this month, on February 4th, Nabisco Mondelez International announced it will close its bakeries in Fairlawn, New Jersey, and Atlanta. The Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers Union and some elected officials were quick to criticize the decision. Anthony Shelton is head of the Bakers Union. He said, "We strongly believe that unionized employees are the most productive and efficient workers in North America. Mondelez is taking a very short-sighted action in an effort to generate corporate profits while devastating communities and families through the closure of these bakeries." We're talking local 719 and 42. They represent the bakery workers in Fairlawn and Atlanta, respectively. That's a sad situation. It's been going on for years. They moved a lot of jobs out of Chicago to Mexico. That was a campaign that they staged to buy your Oreos or Nabisco crackers, look at the package and see if they're made in New Jersey. Now they're closing that bakery. Braving bitter cold temperatures across much of the country, hundreds of union members, environmental activists, and community groups turned out in force on a national day of action. This was this last Saturday, all to raise awareness of the IUECWA's campaign to save union jobs at the GE Savant lighting plant in Bucyrus, Ohio, and actually help the environment. Let me explain. According to the union, GE Savant intends to transfer its LED light bulb product line to China, which will permanently lay off more than 80 workers and most likely close the plant. The president of Local 81201 is Adam Kaczynski, and he said, "People are saying that if these jobs go, then it's only a matter of time that the plant closes. The hypocrisy of the situation is glaring because they're going to have to send these back from China to sell them in the United States. And you know what that means? It increases the carbon footprint." He points out that Walmart certainly has the power to demand that these light bulbs are manufactured in Bucyrus, Ohio. So Kaczynski led rallies with the North Shore Labor Council at Walmart stores in Lynn and Salem, Massachusetts. Again, 80-some jobs, Bucyrus, Ohio. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago when we had one of the union organizers in Dayton, Ohio, and they've got this campaign going. It's going nationally, and it's really sad. It's just, you know, one chip after another chip after another chip, and before you know it, you don't have any manufacturing jobs in the United States. All right, we have to break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Coming up next, Bill Samuel of the Labor Federation.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio.
United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with prostate, breast, or any other cancer after taking Zantac? You may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF. Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find them online at OFT-AFT, part of the American Federation of Teachers. Let's go to line number two. Welcome one of our regulars. I always enjoy talking to this gentleman because he's so clued in on what's happening with regard to pensions, minimum wage, COVID relief, you name it. Bill Samuel is Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO, aflcio.org. Hey, Bill, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today, buddy?
We're doing a lot better. It's been a lot better since January 20th.
Things are happening.
Things are looking up. Things are happening.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you know, one of my friends, Chris LaGrange, he runs the UCOM blog. UConnBlog.com is a website. Great labor guy. Works out of the New England area and New York area, New Jersey. And he pointed out the 20 things that Biden has done for unions. And it's amazing. It's amazing. It's almost like it happened overnight, and it's all good. In fact, the latest was the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, Jennifer Abruzzo. Do you know her, by the way?
I know her very well. In fact, not only did he nominate a union side attorney, by the way, she had worked at the NLRB, so she's a professional. She has lots of experience before she went to CWA, so that she's a good pick. But he fired, he made room for this new general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, by firing the old general counsel on the first day of his presidency. And the old general counsel, Peter Robb, was a management lawyer who was on a mission to destroy unions. He was moving cases and rulemakings through the board at a really quick pace. And we told the president-elect, you've got to get rid of this guy because he could do a lot of damage, you know, in the first 90 days mm-hmm. of your term. And he fired him on day one.
That's
one of the 20 things. I think, by the way, I think there's more than 20 things he's done.
Yeah, Bill, our dear friend Virginia Fox out of North Carolina, who hates unions, and she is the Republican leader on the Education and Labor Committee. She was quick to comment on Jennifer Abruzzo's appointment. She said, rather than nominate a demonstrated union sympathizer with a potential conflict of interest, Biden should reinstate Peter Robb so he can honorably serve out the remainder of his four-year term.
You know, it just shows you how twisted they are. I mean, calling Jennifer a union sympathizer as if that's a bad thing. If you go back and read the National Labor Relations Act, which I'm sure you've talked about, you know, countless times on the show, it actually begins by saying it is the policy of the United States government to encourage collective bargaining. Now, I don't know if that makes a union sympathizer a bad thing, but it sure doesn't sound that way. It sounds like that's something you want in that job, to promote collective bargaining and organizing. And President Biden has actually gone a little bit further. He's now saying it's the policy of his administration to support union organizing and collective bargaining. He said that, early in his presidency. And it really is that the board is going to be totally transformed. There's a vacancy now, in addition to the general counsel being replaced. There's a vacancy on the board, which will give us a 3-2 majority, which will mean all the cases that come forward from this point forward are going to be decided by a much better, fairer board that actually believes in collective bargaining and union organizing.
That's great. Really great. Now he's got to clean up the post office. And I know that's going to take a little more time because of the way it's structured with the Board of Governors. In that situation, there's vacancies on that board. And if he fills those, then they can fire DeJoy. Is that right?
I believe that's right. There's three vacancies. He nominated three people yesterday who the postal unions have supported. There's a fourth who's in a about to, I think, position that's expired, Ron Blum. We expect him to be renominated. I believe that gives, sort of the pro-postal service side a majority, a 4-3 majority on the board. And I don't know what it takes to fire the Postmaster General, but I know they hired him. So presumably they can fire him as well, and hopefully that's what they'll do because he's made a mess of the Postal Service. And headlines today in the paper, I'm sure you've seen, he's recommending slowing down first-class mail. So he basically wants to destroy the Postal Service and turn the business over to the private industry. That seems to be his long-term goal.
Yeah, and he had an interesting hearing. It was just yesterday in Congress and all. And everybody's upset because they're still getting their Christmas mail.
I mean,
come on. I mean, what did this guy do to the post office? I mean, it's been around since, what, 1789 or something like
that's
that?
That's right. Benjamin Franklin, wasn't he the first postmaster general? No, they say that, you got to run the Postal Service like a business. Well, they're running it into the ground like a lot of businesses that have been running into the ground over
yeah.
the years.
Just like Trump's businesses. How many of them filed for bankruptcy,
Exactly.
Oh, my
That's
God.
Exactly right.
Well, I got to salute. There's been, and the unions have been really, really vigilant and vocal on this. This week, four petitions were sent to Biden and Congress to replace the Postal Service Board with a new board, which would eventually get rid of Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General. They have 1.12 million signatures calling for DeJoy's ouster. So eventually, I know Biden's got a lot on his plate. I do understand that. But eventually, it's going to get there. And we have to take some action on this because I cannot believe how bad the Postal Service is because of what they've done.
It is a quasi-independent agency. So I'm not sure he can, with the stroke of a pen, fire the Postmaster General. I'd have to look into that. But I do think the board can do it. And once he gets a majority of the board, I think that hopefully that's the first thing they're going to do.
Yeah. The first thing that DeJoy did was he got rid of the sorting machines.
That's right. And I remember before the election, we saw the sorting machines sitting out in the parking lot. And then we saw post mailboxes being picked up and put on the back of trucks. We all assumed that was to, destroy the vote by mail. A program which fortunately we managed to get around and elect Joe Biden anyway.
And I can't even think how many seniors are affected by this because many of them get their prescriptions via mail.
Right.
And they're delayed. They're waiting for them for weeks and they're not getting them.
Some people still get checks by mail. Yeah, people still depend on it.
It's criminal. All right. Let's switch over to the rescue bill here. This is the $1.9 trillion rescue package. And it's my understanding it might pass the House tomorrow. What do you hear?
It should pass Friday. It should pass tomorrow and then head over to the Senate. We have a deadline. It's got to become law by March 14th. That's when the expanded unemployment insurance pandemic program expires. That they passed at the end of last year. And I think they're on track to do that. And this is really a remarkable success for us and for everybody. It's got all the elements that we've been pushing since last May, this rescue plan, American Rescue Plan, pension relief. It's got money for state and local governments. It has money for transportation, keep transit systems operating and airline workers employed. It's got direct payments. It's got education money. It's obviously has money for COVID, for distribution of the vaccine. It sort of meets all the priorities that we have set out, and we're really happy about it. And we don't need any Republican votes. It would be great to have some, but because it's moving as part of the budget reconciliation process, it can't be filibustered in the Senate. It only takes 51 votes. And we think we're going to get there next week in the Senate or the week after, but certainly in time for the March 14th deadline and make sure those unemployment checks keep going to people who need it. There's millions and millions of people depending on these checks. It's keeping our economy from really, going down the tubes. And I think this Democratic House and Senate and Democratic president are finally going to get the job done.
Here's the part that I'm concerned about, Bill, and it's reaching across the aisle. And Biden said he wanted to enjoin everybody, and I understand that. But That's not easy to achieve, especially when you got some Republicans that don't even think he should be in office. But nonetheless, it would be good to have bipartisan support. And I want to get into the pension part, too. And that might be a sticking point. And the minimum wage part, too. I don't know if that's going to stay in the whole legislation.
Right. I mean, listen, bipartisanship is a worthy goal, but it's not an end in itself. And I think if we rely on bipartisanship when we can pass things that are needed without it, we should do it. And we've been very clear with the administration, and a lot of Democrats are feeling the same way. As, you know, you may remember in 2009 when President Obama was elected, he was all about bipartisanship and not forcing bills through, even though we had a Democratic majority. And he waited and he waited and he waited, and he compromised on the original rescue plan and on the Affordable Care Act, and ended up getting no Republican votes, and Congress, you know, passed bills that weren't as strong as they could have been. You know, we gave up the public option in health care. The rescue plan in 2009 was, I think, $780 billion. It should have been well over a trillion. You know, every economist now says it was too small. And that was purely a result of wanting to make it bipartisan and getting a few Republican votes. And I think it was, I think it's, in retrospect, it was a mistake. And the good thing is that the people around Joe Biden now were there then, and they say the same thing, that it was a mistake. My guess is Joe Biden thinks it was a mistake. So, listen, we're for bipartisanship, but we're not going to let it drag down his agenda, and hopefully he won't either.
I got you. What's the controversy over the minimum wage? I mean, the wage has not gone up since, what, 2009?
2007 was the last vote that was taken, and then 2009, it was the last time it actually went up. This is, you know, we've had this debate going for probably, you know, 85 years. I think the first minimum wage passed in the 1930s. And we're, you know, it's long past time. There isn't a community in this country where you can raise a family or take care of, you know, children on $7.25 an hour, you know, which is, what, about $14,000 a year, a little bit over that. And this minimum wage is critical to keeping our economy moving, especially when we've got so many people working low-wage jobs. But this is going to lift, I don't know, 17 million people. 17 million people will get a raise. It'll lift a million people out of poverty, particularly, again, you know, children. This is long overdue, and it's part of the reconciliation package that the president sent to Congress a few weeks ago. The only question now is, does it fit in this reconciliation procedure? This, I mentioned, the budget reconciliation is special procedures to get the budget passed. As I said, it can't be filibustered. It will not take any Democratic votes to get it through. But it does have to pass muster with the Senate parliamentarian. It's kind of bizarre if you think of it. You know, an unelected, basically, you know, staff person hired by the Senate as a parliamentarian can decide what goes in and what doesn't and what can be taken out of reconciliation. And the minimum wage is probably the most vulnerable to that a decision by the parliamentarian. So we're waiting to see if we could hear about it today, whether or not it'll fit. Now, Democrats don't have to listen to the parliamentarian. They can actually ignore the parliamentarian's advice. I think it's only been done once or twice in the history of the Budget Act, which goes back to the 1974. So there's a possibility. Democrats really want to get this done. But if they can't, we're going to have to find another way. Of course, the filibuster itself is really questionable. It's certainly not a Democratic, small-d Democratic rule, you know, that it takes a supermajority to pass really anything in the Senate. So I think they're going to take another look at that, too. And that may be another way to pass the minimum wage if it doesn't make it through under budget reconciliation.
So what I'm hearing, get it done. No matter what, get
absolutely
it done. That's what
get
it sounds
it done.
Like.
It has been way too long. You know, and states are moving ahead because they're impatient. And red states, you know, Florida passed a minimum wage to $15, and they voted for Trump. This has happened, you know, over and over again. I've been around now for two minimum wage increases, 97 and then 2007. And each time, states moved ahead of the federal government, and the federal government, finally, Congress caught up and did it at the federal level. You don't want different state minimum wages. It may sound attractive to business because they can go to the lowest wage state and set up there, but you don't want states competing with each other on the basis of who can pay lower wages. That's right to work, basically. It's the same idea.
Yeah.
And it hasn't helped those states that have taken that have gone in that direction.
All right, I got to take a break. When we come back, there's two things I want to get into. Pension relief and the PRO Act. We'll do that.
Great.
Bill Samuel on our live line, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Later in the show, Andrew Tinkham will be joining us to talk about National Consumer Protection Week on behalf of the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Chris LaGrange here, host of UCOM Live with Chris LaGrange, news, talk, sports, and workforce politics, the fastest growing podcast on, in, and around the internet. Join us live every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter with archives on UCOMLive.com. Our loud and colorful panelists bring you current events like no other. So follow and subscribe today wherever great podcasts are found.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce, available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and most recently, Pandora. Let's go back to our live line, rejoin Bill Samuel on behalf of the Labor Federation, AFL-CIO.org. Bill is the Government Affairs Director. Want to talk about pensions and the PRO Act, but I'd love to get your take. I bet you Rich Trumka was pretty happy after that White House meeting with all the union leaders talking about infrastructure, what needs to be done. What did he tell you, Bill?
Well, he came back and said, and he wasn't the only one. You know, there were about a dozen union leaders in the rooms, including a number of building trades presidents, and they all came back believing that Joe Biden is committed to proposing and getting passed a really historic infrastructure investment bill, and one that really celebrates unions and protects union jobs and promotes union jobs. He was all about building back better with unions, which is a slogan that we've adopted. And he and his administration have talked about repeatedly since January 20th, building back better with unions. And I think the folks who were in that meeting, which went well over at the time allotted, I think they spent an hour and a half with him in the Oval Office. It was supposed to be about an hour. And they all came back believing that this guy is for real. He really is going to be the most pro-union, pro-jobs president in anybody's memory. And he's talking about a multi-trillion dollar investment. And I think it's going to come right after this COVID relief bill. I think he's going to start talking to Congress about this second, what they're calling a recovery bill. The COVID bill is the rescue bill, American Rescue Plan. And the recovery bill is coming next, and I think that's what they were talking about in that meeting. And they all came back very enthusiastic about the president's commitment.
Well, in that COVID relief bill, we have pension reform. I'd like to get your take on that. We had the Teamsters on yesterday, and he was real optimistic. This was the concern from the Teamster. It'll pass the House tomorrow, I guess, in the legislation. He's concerned about the Senate, and you know there's some senators that don't want to help out with regard to pensions, and they might try to carve that out. I'd like to get your take on that, Bill.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about this a minute ago. It's not going to take any Republican votes under this budget reconciliation procedure, and that's where the pension provisions are they're in this COVID relief bill, which is again part of this sort of streamlined procedure to get through the Senate without a filibuster. So it's not going to take any Republican votes. It really is a terrific piece of legislation that made its way into this bill. It takes care of all the pensions that are in trouble now and for the next 2 years. So if they're declining or insolvent over the next 2 years, they're going to get relief under this package. We think it's about $6 billion a year. It's going to mean that nobody who's relying on a pension will suffer a decrease in the amount, and the money will keep flowing from the government to these plans until 2051. 30 years, so they're guaranteed for 30 years without a decrease in the benefit amount. It's really kind of remarkable that we got this done. We've been trying to do this for some years now, and the Teamsters have been one of the leading unions to get this done. And I think obviously we got to work at it. We got to do more than keep our fingers crossed. We got to make sure it survives any challenge on the Senate floor. The president said he'll sign it, and I think we're on track to get this done. It's a really kind of an amazing thing that the government is finally, standing behind pensions the way it stands behind corporations when they run into trouble, whether it was, Chrysler or, the banks, the insurance companies. Congress is always quick to bail them out, and these pension plans, which are in trouble through no fault of their own because of changes in the economy, need federal support, and I think they're going to get it, and we're very happy about it.
Yeah, they're quick to help out the corporations, but very, very slow when it comes to helping out workers. And I could hear some of the conservatives saying, "Oh, this is a union bailout."
They are saying that's
going to happen.
They are saying that, and it goes back to a bigger discussion we can have another time about these Trump voters. Many of whom are working class voters, many of whom rely on Medicare, a union pension, you name it, the VA, and they're and the Republicans, and Trump's gone now, but there are a lot of Republicans who are left who still don't believe in the role government should be playing in supporting these folks when they're retired or sick, and we just got to convince them that, and maybe this will help convince them. When they see these checks coming. Maybe they'll realize that it's in this case it was Joe Biden that made it happen, not the Republican Party.
And think about how many people took that haircut on their pensions. And it's my understanding with passage of this bill, they're not going to get all the old money back, the money that they lost. But from this point on, they will be full, right?
That's right. That's right. They'll restore the pensions that were cut. That's right.
Great, great, great. All right, couple minutes left. PROACT, and you're telling me off the air here that's next on the agenda for Biden, is that right?
This is big news. Steny Hoyer, who's the House Majority Leader, and Speaker Pelosi announced yesterday to the caucus in a private meeting that they're going to schedule the PROACT for a vote the week of March 8th, which is right around the corner. We have the votes to pass it. They're committed to getting it done. It'll be one of the first major bills passed in the 117th Congress. Obviously, they will have done COVID relief, which is certainly a priority, and we need to get that done right away. And really, this one of the second major bills that they're going to bring to the floor and pass is the PRO Act, Protecting the Right to Organize Act. We already have the votes to do it. We've been, our affiliates and activists have been working, nonstop since Election Day to get Democrats to co-sponsor the bill. We've got some Republicans supporting it, at least three who are co-sponsors. We think we'll get two more votes when it's on the floor. And we hope to pass it with about 222 votes. It'll be, it's tight. I mean, you need 218 mm-hmm. if everybody's there. But I think we have enough to do it. And the majority leader and the speaker have committed to bringing it up, and I think that shows their determination to make a labor a priority in this Congress and support workers who want to organize and lift their wages and benefits. And so now it's on to the Senate after that, and that's a whole other story. We could spend an hour talking about how to get something through the Senate. The filibuster is still there, and we don't think we can put the PRO Act in a budget reconciliation bill, which we talked about a minute ago. Although we may try. we may try. So we'll figure it out a way. We still have a few Democrats who are not on board in the Senate. So that's
really
we've got some targets. There are five of them. We've got 45 co-sponsors on the Senate bill. We need 50 and the vice president. So there are five that we still have to work on.
I'm a little surprised by that. Are you at liberty to throw some names out here?
So maybe I certainly can. We put them on a billboard if I have to. Both Arizona Democrats, Mark Kelly, who was just elected, and Kirsten Sinema, neither of them are co-sponsors. The independent in Maine, Angus King, who caucuses with the Democrats. Joe Manchin, your neighbor in West Virginia.
Oh, no.
Is not a co-sponsor, and right next door to him is Mark Warner from Virginia. So those five are not co-sponsors. Well, I have a pretty good feeling about Manchin and Warner that they will vote for it when it's on the floor. They're a little reluctant to get out front now. I suspect Mark Kelly is the same place. I think the last two we're going to get are going to be Kirsten Sinema and Angus King from Arizona and Maine, respectively. But I think we'll get them. I think Chuck Schumer is a good majority leader. He's going to figure out a way to get all 50 Democrats on record soon for the PRO Act. And then we just have to figure out how to get around the filibuster and the Senate obstructionism. And, I mean, I'll leave you with this. I think Democrats are going to lose patience with Mitch McConnell if he attempts to do what he did to President Obama when he was in office, which was filibuster everything. He allowed nothing to get through the gate there. And I think Democrats are going to lose patience, and hopefully the American people will, too. It won't just be the PRO Act. There are going to be a lot of bills that are going to get hung up with this supermajority rule, and hopefully, and it can be changed. I mean, it's not on the Constitution. There's nothing that says it should take 60 votes to pass ordinary legislation. And so hopefully we'll get it done one way or another.
One to watch. Good one. All right, buddy, I'm going to let you go. You take care. Thank you for the great conversation. Learned a lot today. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot. We'll talk to you in a month, all right?
Great, thank you. I look forward to it.
Bill Samuel of the Labor Federation, Government Affairs Director, AFL-CIO.org for more information. Quick break. Andrew Tinkham on behalf of the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council. He's next.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
Let's be honest. The National Symphony may not be in his future, but he wanted to try violin. So you said yes because you love him. And if you love him that much, love him enough to make sure he's buckled up and in the back seat. Find out more about keeping your kids safe in your vehicle at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show him you love him. Keep him safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce on Facebook. You can check us out at AWF Union Podcast and follow us on Twitter. That would be AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to our live line and join Andrew Tinkham. Andrew is with the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council, and for the week of February 28th through March 6th, it is known as National Consumer Protection Week. And Andrew is going to talk about National Consumer Protection Week, its history and what it's all about. Hey, Andrew, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having our office on your show today.
So this was created, I guess, in the late 90s. Give me a little history in what this is all about, why we're doing this.
Yes, yeah, National Consumer Protection Week was created by the Federal Trade Commission, and it was in an effort to educate people about their rights as a consumer and how to protect their money and personal identity. Back in 1998, the Federal Trade Commission did create National Consumer Protection Week, and they held their first annual National Consumer Protection Week in February of 1999. What's been great about National Consumer Protection Week is it brings together a bunch of government agencies and nonprofit organizations nationally to educate consumers on how to protect themselves from scams. And it's done in many platforms. We've done presentations. Unfortunately, this year we won't be able to do in-person presentations, but in the past we've done public presentations. There have been consumer protection fairs where consumers can come out and get information on how to protect themselves from scams. We've done phone banks through TV stations where callers can call in and ask questions about scams and fraud. We do radio public service announcements. So it's a great way for government entities to get together for 1 week and educate consumers on a state and national level. And the types of agencies that are involved is, like I said, the Federal Trade Commission, which created National Consumer Protection Week, the Federal Communications Commission, the United States Postal Inspection Services. On your state level, the attorney general's offices around the country are getting involved. Here in Ohio, the Ohio Attorney General's Office is always heavily involved in National Consumer Protection Week. And I even get the nonprofit-type organizations, local banks, the Better Business Bureau. Like I said, as a group, we get together and able to educate consumers on scams that are happening. Once again, this year, it's going to look a little different with the pandemic. Most of the programming is going to be virtual. I know our office is going to be partnering with numerous federal and state and nonprofit organizations to hold virtual presentations, which we've already been scheduling. Now, if you are in Ohio, certainly go out to our Twitter page, and we are posting our virtual presentations so you can know where they would be held and how to participate. Now, one thing with National Consumer Protection Week, and as an office, we are certainly going to be educating consumers on utility scams that we're currently seeing. And this includes some of the four common utility scams, which include caller ID spoofing, utility disconnection threats, overpayment trick with utilities, and door-to-door solicitors. Now, what we're finding is most consumers have caller ID. You know, this day and age, most people have it in their home, and I'm not sure I've met a cell phone that doesn't have caller ID.
Right.
But scammers, what we're finding is they're using caller ID spoofing to try to trick consumers into answering their phone. And unfortunately, with this technology, when a call comes in from a scammer, it can appear it's coming from the local utility, or it might appear it's coming from a federal government office like the IRS or Social Security.
Uh-huh.
Or it might appear it's coming from a local bank, and you've probably seen this flash. Some of them just look like they're coming from your local community. You know, the area code and the prefix appear to be coming, you know. And what they're trying to do is obviously trying to get you to answer the phone. I think the most important thing to know is get one of these calls coming in, and the caller ID, even if it looks legitimate, if you're not expecting a call from one of those government agencies or companies, if you have voicemail or an answer machine, you know, let them leave a message. If it is important enough to leave a message and a callback number, at that point, you can look into it further. If they do leave a voicemail message and they state they're with your utility or they state they're with a federal government agency, don't call the number back if they leave a message. Make sure you do your research and find a number from a reputable website for that government agency or utility. Or if it's a utility, look for that number on the back of the bill, because you want to make sure you're talking to a trusted source. It's very important for consumers to know that what does appear on your caller ID might not be accurate. It's very possible that it's coming from a scammer, and they're masking themselves as an agency or a business, and they're not really with. And I want to give you an example where we've seen this, and this is through the emergency payment scam. The emergency payment scam is where a scammer calls a consumer and they pose as the utility company, and they threaten to disconnect your service in a short amount of time. And when I say that, they usually give you 30 to 60 minutes to make a payment. The scammer will direct the customer to go to a local grocery store, convenience store, gas station, and they instruct the customer to purchase like $500 in a prepaid Visa debit card, or they request a $500 Apple iTunes card or a $500 Amazon card. And what they do is they tell the consumer that we'll call you back in 60 minutes, or sometimes they'll provide you a 1-800 number to call back. And when you call that 1-800 number back, it sounds very official with prompts. And so what they do is they want to get that information on the back of the card as part of the payment to stop the disconnection of service. But in reality, it's just a scammer stealing money from consumers, unfortunately. And, you know, with this scam, what's kind of scary about it is, you know, when you get these type of calls, especially like the weather we've been experiencing, it's been very cold and snowy. You know, that's very concerning to think that you might lose your heat, whether you heat with electric or natural gas. No one wants to lose that. So they use that scare tactic to get consumers to hand over their money. Here in Ohio, utilities must provide a disconnection notice, a written disconnection notice year-round if they're going to disconnect service. In the winter months, they must provide a second disconnection notice on top of the first one. So utilities do not disconnect in this form or fashion. So be very careful with that scam. You know, don't want to see anyone losing money, and especially in a pandemic, you know, outside of having to make that payment, but to actually go into a store where a consumer might not normally do that, you know, that's also very, very concerning. And on the flip side, what we've seen with caller ID spoofing is, instead of, like we just said, where it's an emergency payment, we've actually seen cases where a consumer or a scammer will call a consumer and tell them they have a credit on their utility bill, and they want to return that credit back to them. But in order to do that, they need your banking account number or your credit card number. Everyone wants a credit, right? Those are the more friendly type calls. But if you get one of these calls and they state that you have a credit on your utility bill, and they start asking for personal information or banking account information, make sure to disconnect the call. At that point, what a consumer can do is they can get their utility bill and call the utility directly, whether it's an overpayment or threatening to disconnect your service. You know, get that number on the back of your utility bill, because you know that's a trusted number that you can call, and you're going to be talking to someone who can give you accurate information on your account. And so we highly recommend consumers, if they get into that situation, to not go make a payment on a disconnection notice, or to provide banking account information if a scammer tells a customer that they have a credit on their account. Once again, you're best to check with the utility, because unfortunately these scams have been going around for years, and they continue, unfortunately.
A lot of good information there, and it's all to call attention to National Consumer Protection Week, which runs February 28th through March 6th. And Andrew Tinkham is here on behalf of the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council. You can get more information at occ-ohio.gov, and you can follow them on Twitter at OCC4Consumers. Andrew, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Flash.
Once again, Andrew Tinkham on behalf of the Office of the Ohio Consumer Council. You can find more about National Consumer Protection Week on occ.ohio.gov. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, our segment on working class perspectives. We're going to talk about what happened in Texas and the latest from the steelworkers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.